than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman.
It makes me want to dance.
Yeah, it makes me want to puke.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Yes, Super Cena has returned, everybody, from the planet Ugh. He'll be back at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view later this month, it was announced. He'll be challenging for the World Heavyweight Championship in his first match back. That was quite the remarkable turnaround from a torn triceps. Guy really is something else. We'll talk about John Cena's return, among other things. Let's get some housekeeping out of the way here. This is episode 296 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, exclusively here on the SolidMonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes for Sunday, October 13, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. For those of you who are not aware, we have an official Sound Off Superstore online at solidmonster.spreadshirt.com. We finally have a official logo t-shirt for the Sound Off up in all kinds of sizes and colors, including now 3XL. I had a whole lot of people write in asking me if we were going to have the bigger sizes. We do. So if you are literally a big fan of the show, you can now pick up your official Sound Off t-shirt. There's also the TNA Total Nonstop Absurdity t-shirt, which actually applied less to this week. I think Impact was a much better show than it was the previous week. But you could pick up that shirt. We also have a case, a logo case now, if you have an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 5S, a Samsung Galaxy 3. There's new items being added every week. So head over to solidmonster.spreadshirt.com, buy a shirt, buy a phone case, whatever you need. Support the show. I very much appreciate it. And also, just so you know, Spreadshirt is having a special Halloween sale that only goes until Tuesday. So this Tuesday the 15th, when you make a purchase for $50 or more, you get to save $10 if you use the coupon code TREAT2013. So again, that extends into Tuesday. If you plan on buying a whole bunch of stuff there, use that code and you can save $10. So just an FYI for anybody who's interested in buying maybe a few items from the Sound Off store. And also, I want to give some shout-outs here to these people who donated via PayPal to the show this past week. My thanks to everybody who did so. Their generosity: Tim Tapp, Brian Bird, John McBride, Jovan Balik, Matt Isaiah, and especially Chuck Lentz. You guys are awesome. Thank you for the support. And thank you to everybody who sent in birthday wishes. I had a great birthday last weekend, in part because of you guys. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. Last weekend was WWE's first ever Battleground pay-per-view, a show that will probably not be remembered, and if it is, probably not very positively. I posted my full thoughts on the Battleground pay-per-view on Monday, actually, the day after the pay-per-view, on the official Sound Off YouTube channel. So you can subscribe there. My username is TheSolidMonster, all one word. If you want to type that in, subscribe, and that way when new videos go up, you'll be informed of them. But my full thoughts are up there. Basically, just to summarize, the entire show is not a complete lost cause. I was a huge fan of the Rhodes family match, their big win over the Shield. I thought the way that whole thing was handled was great. It was a great match, great, you know, story, great drama. The fans reacted to it. You know, Dusty gave the bionic elbow. People went nuts. I thought the finish was fantastic. Cody gave probably the best crossroads I've ever seen, thanks largely to Seth Rollins, who took it like a champ and sold it like a champ. The stuff afterwards, the family members embracing, the baby faces coming out on stage, I thought that whole thing was fantastic. So I can't give the pay-per-view a complete thumbs down because of that match, but by no means was it a good show. And the main event finish was absolutely horrendous. I've seen some people attempt to defend it. There is no defense for a finish like that when people paid $50 or more for a pay-per-view. You want to advance the story with Big Show. You know, they had a big payoff on Raw the next night that we'll get into in a second here. That's fine. I have no problem with them advancing the story. I happen to like part of the story they're telling. I think Big Show, at least in his role, has been great. But for a pay-per-view main event, you can't end the show that way. With a non-finish, guy comes out, beats everybody up, his music plays, there's no decision. It's ridiculous that you could actually, you know, do that and expect people are going to turn around 3 weeks later because you got two shows in 1 month, and they're going to buy your next pay-per-view. When we saw on Monday night, they're really stacking the deck for this next show, I think, in part because they realize people haven't really been thrilled with the last couple of pay-per-views since SummerSlam. We've got to really give them a reason to think this time, okay, this time we promise we're not going to fuck you over. We're going to give you a winner. We've got John Cena coming back. Shawn Michaels is going to be there. They're loading that show up, and they have to. Because when you have a finish like you had at Battleground, you have people that just go, hell with it. I'm not going to buy these shows anymore. I'm either not going to watch or I'm going to stream them. Why would I spend $50 and get slapped in the face? And so anyway, I talk more about that, and I also talk about what WWE should do going forward with these non-major pay-per-view shows. There has to be a change in how they price these shows out. There just has to be, because those shows are not worth the money they're charging for them. It's interesting that fewer people are ordering these pay-per-views today compared to years ago, and yet prices keep going up, 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 and that has to change. So you could check that out on YouTube. The MP3 audio, for those who like listening to it on their device, on the their commute and what have you, in all these YouTube videos, these reviews that I do, you can find a link to the MP3 file in the video description. These things are not pushed to iTunes or Stitcher because they're intended to be exclusive to YouTube. But if you want the audio, that's how you can get it, just so you know going forward. Also, later tonight, so by the time most of you listen to this, it should be up, I'm going to get up the Triple H DVD review that I had promised a few weeks ago. The review for his new Thy Kingdom Come release is going up on the official Sound Off YouTube channel as well. It's a two-disc set. The big attraction, I guess, with this DVD is the documentary. They filmed a completely new documentary on Triple H's career. They have a sit-down interview with him. A bunch of new comments from guys that they brought up to Connecticut. Dave Bautista gives some fresh commentary on there. Kevin Nash. They have some old comments from The Rock, a little bit from Brock Lesnar. The Undertaker, hoodie and all, is on the DVD, out of character, giving his thoughts on Triple H and his career and his relationship with Stephanie and the advice he gave Triple H. There's a lot of interesting things and a lot of rare footage, especially footage from early on in Triple H's career that I don't believe has been included in any DVDs previous to this. There's him at Killer Kowalski school training, him wrestling on his first show, looks like an indie show in a gym somewhere. So there's a lot of interesting things like that throughout the entire documentary. They also have another disc with full matches. They have some Blu-ray extras if you have the Blu-ray version. So I go pretty in-depth into everything. If you haven't gotten the DVD or weren't even thinking about it or were on the fence, you're not a Triple H fan, you just hate the guy's guts for whatever reason, and you don't want to watch the DVD, you might want to rethink that. I give, my thoughts on all that stuff, the good and the bad. It's not a perfect DVD. By no means is it the best one they've put out, probably not even in the last couple of years. But you can check that video out. If it's not up by now, it will be up later tonight on the official Sound Off YouTube channel. So please leave your thoughts, leave comments in the video, and subscribe to our channel. We'll be putting more videos like that up in the future. Raw this past Monday night emanated from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And the big news coming out of this show was the return of John Cena. John Cena will be back in a couple of weeks at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. Vicky Guerrero announcing that Alberto Del Rio will have to defend his World Heavyweight Championship against the former world champion. Cena did hold that belt once before. I'm happy, he's healthy enough to return. I kind of joked a little bit earlier, from the planet Ugg and all that. But I don't hate the guy. I'm happy to see that he's doing better, and he's on his way back a little bit early, which I know not everybody is thrilled about. But I think that even if he is fully recovered from this injury, which just boggles my mind, that he could be fully recovered already from an injury like the one he had and get cleared. But he did. He did get cleared by doctors. They had an interview up with him right now on WWE.com where he tries to explain how it's possible for him to come back this soon. And the excuse he gives is, the doctors tend to err on the side of caution. So when they give these timetables for a comeback, they usually go with the extreme viewpoint that if you have an injury that's going to keep you out, let's say, 4 to 6 months, they'll probably say, you can expect to be back in 6 months, when maybe in reality it's closer to four. I think they told Cena 4 to 6 months, and he's coming back in two. I mean, it's just completely ridiculous. I think WWE missed an opportunity here to hold off on his return for another couple of months and save him for the Royal Rumble. Not even as a surprise. I'm not saying he had to come out as a surprise like he did back in 08. They can announce it in advance. It could be one of the selling points for the pay-per-view for all the Cena fans out there. And just give us another couple of Cena-free months. You know what they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. The people who hate the guy, just absolutely hate him to their core, are going to hate him no matter what. He could be gone for an entire year. They'd probably still boo him when he came back. But for a lot of other fans who don't necessarily hate the guy, but they're just tired of his shtick and they're tired of seeing him in main events every single month, I think another couple of months and maybe people would be more, you know, happy to hear that John Cena was coming back. I can't really say that I miss the guy too much since it feels like he's only been gone for 2 months. And that's because he has only been gone for 2 months. Actually, not even that long. The way they're doing this, it just feels kind of thrown together. No build-up or anything. Just, hey, John Cena's back, and he's wrestling for the World Championship. The reports are that Cena had only a partially torn triceps when they actually opened him up, when they went in and saw the actual injury. And it wasn't as bad as they had originally feared. So, therefore, I guess his timetable for recovery would have been shorter. But still, I mean, 9 weeks for a torn triceps is really not that long at all. I mean, it sure sounds to me like what they did here is they embellished the severity of the injury, or at least the timetable for a return, just so they could shock people when he comes back early. Either that, or they really do want us to believe that he's Superman. I mean, can you imagine the 7 levels of hate that people would have for that Batman vs. Superman movie they're working on if they would have cast Cena as the Man of Steel, opposite Ben Affleck as Batman? I think people's heads would explode seeing those two guys on the screen together. But you know what? I have decided that I will never again believe another word out of WWE's mouth when it comes to John Cena injuries. I mean, how could you? How could anybody believe what they say? Let's say he goes down with another torn muscle or a neck injury or something, and they say, oh, you know, John Cena's going to have an operation. He's going to be out for 5 months. Who in their right mind would ever believe them? It's impossible. So, how might this affect Daniel Bryan and his spot on the roster? That was one of the questions that I had after hearing that Cena was coming back. And it may not affect him at all. If the idea is really to keep Cena glued to the World Heavyweight title, assuming he wins it, and they let Bryan, Orton, and Big Show continue their program for the WWE Championship, then it may not affect him hardly at all. You know, we all know Cena is he's the face of the company. But if they stick to the storyline that whoever holds the WWE title is the face of WWE, and let's say Daniel Bryan does eventually get the belt back, that's good for Bryan. That way, Cena doesn't, you know, encroach on his territory for a few more months, and then you could always build to a John Cena versus Daniel Bryan rematch from SummerSlam. I mean, hell, y'all know my thoughts on having two world titles in this company, okay? If they wanted to have Cena win the world title and build to a unification match at some point with him and Bryan, I'd have no problem with that at all. Actually, him against anybody in a unification match. And I understand that Cena will, you know, would probably win that match and get his win back over Bryan if they ever have a rematch together. I get that. But you know what? To unify those belts, it would be totally worth it. Will he help elevate the world championship if he wins it? Yeah, probably. Just by holding it, he'll probably elevated in the eyes of the fans who don't otherwise give a crap about it. But once he loses it, it all goes back to the way it was, which is to say, it'll be the opening match on most pay-per-views. So until they unify them, I don't think that's ever going to change. You know, Cena's return has everything to do with them being desperate. They're desperate to get this guy back on TV. They want to reverse this trend of declining pay-per-view buys, even SummerSlam, which I thought was a great show. I thought the two top matches they promoted delivered, over-delivered, in the case of Punk and Lesnar. And even SummerSlam was the lowest SummerSlam number since 1997. So they're on a downward spiral here when it comes to these pay-per-view numbers, and they're desperate to turn that around. It's a business decision, above all else, to bring Cena back. I'm sure he's also been dying to come back. You know, the guy's a workhorse. I respect that. He loves what he does. I think it's very likely that Cena wins the world title at Hell in a Cell, and this almost mirrors his comeback in 2008, the second one, not the first one at the Rumble that year. You know, he suffered a herniated disc in his neck in the summer. They played it off like it was, you know, the injury happened in that match with Batista, but I think he knew he was hurt before that. But that was their storyline excuse for his injury. So Cena went away to have neck surgery, and they announced his return for Survivor Series in a match against Chris Jericho for the world title. I'm not sure what he did to deserve the shot, but he got it. He beat Jericho for the belt. I think we'll see the same thing in Hell in a Cell. That way they could do split touring at the live events with Cena as champion on one set of shows, and they can keep Bryan and Orton and Punk and all those guys on the other tours. Cena is scheduled for all the upcoming pay-per-views, so it's not a situation where they're going to bring him back early for a match, do an injury angle, and then he goes away again for a few months. I also don't think they're going to have him win only to lose to Damian Sandow, have Sandow cash in his Money in the Bank, because it appears that Damian Sandow is turning babyface. I saw SmackDown this week. They had Sandow out there face-to-face with Del Rio at the beginning of the show, totally acting like a babyface. They had a match later on in the show where he was certainly playing the role of being the babyface. He was having the comeback. Some people were into him. He ended up tapping out to the armbar, but this appeared to be the start of a potential babyface turn on this show. And it's interesting also that after the show, I don't know if you read the taping results, but after the show they had a 20-man battle royal, dark match, that came down to the Wyatt family and Titus O'Neil. So they get rid of O'Neil, and the last three men in the battle royal are Harper, Rowan, and Bray Wyatt. So Harper and Rowan eliminate themselves, they give Bray Wyatt the win, and that leads to a Bray Wyatt Alberto Del Rio World Championship match at the end of the taping. This, of course, did not air on TV. And what ends up happening is, I think Del Rio may have just ran away or something and got counted out, but then Sandow came out, and the crowd went nuts for him, probably because they thought he was cashing in Money in the Bank, and the Wyatts beat him up before he had a chance to do so. So yeah, very interesting the way they use Sandow on this show. Supposedly he's been told not to do those cartwheels anymore, not to sing. Basically all the fun stuff he would do as a comedy heel, they've supposedly told him not to do that anymore. That's, to me anyway, a surefire sign they're at least going to test the waters on a babyface turn. How the fans are going to react to him, I don't know. They're into his catchphrase and everything as a heel. To take him as a babyface, unless maybe he's like a tweener for a little while, I don't know. I'm actually very interested to see A, if the fans take to him as a babyface, and B, how far they go with it. But that certainly seems like they're testing the waters for that. And by the way, I thought the Los Matadores versus Los Locales match on SmackDown Friday night was actually a lot of fun. For those who didn't read about it, it was actually Ricardo Rodriguez and Tyson Kidd under Lucha Mask. Ricardo does the El Local gimmick anyway, sometimes down on NXT. And for whatever reason, I guess they just decided to put Tyson Kidd under a mask and make them a tag team. Felt like one of those late 80s, early 90s squash matches on Superstars where they bring in a couple of masked guys to basically get jobbed out. They had very little of any offense in the match. I just thought the match was fun. Not a lot of star power at all on SmackDown this week, though. Probably Sandow and Del Rio were the biggest stars in the entire show. I mean, Cody and Goldust were there as well, the Wyatts, but they were very thin on star talent this week on SmackDown. So let's talk about Raw, though, from this past Monday night. We got the giant swing and the big payoff at the end with Big Show knocking out Triple H for free on this show Monday night, the night after the pay-per-view that people paid $50 to see. If anything, I think that makes it even worse. But Raw itself was a very newsworthy show. Not a great one, but way better than the pay-per-view the night before, and it should never be that way. We had Stephanie and Big Show opening the show. Big Show called Triple H her son-of-a-bitch husband. Stephanie smacked him around, and she fired him. And Big Show, all of a sudden, Big Show doesn't seem to care. He was smiling. He was like, all right, you fired me. Fine. And he walked off. Could be a tease for the impending return of Vince McMahon. I mean, I guess it could be that Big Show knows that Vince will take care of him and give him his job back, because we certainly didn't see crying Big Show on this show Monday night. So unless he's got hormones like a woman and his emotions fluctuate wildly from crying to laughing, that would be the only logical explanation for why Big Show didn't seem at all bothered by the fact that he lost his job, especially since he's basically an indentured servant, right? He's got no money. What's he going to do now, live in the street? Certainly no box that he can fit into on the street corner anywhere. Dolph Ziggler beat a way more aggressive Damian Sandow than we've ever seen before, which probably plays into the Sandow we saw on SmackDown at the tapings the following night. Ziggler, it was weird, you know, Ziggler had some wild hair going on in this match. He looked a lot like Kurt Hennig out there, you know, more so than he usually does, I guess. And for some reason, the announcers now make it a point to mention Billy Gunn by name every time Ziggler uses the Famouser, as he did here to win the match. I'm not sure what that's all about, but I know Billy Gunn does work for them now down in developmental. He's one of Triple H's guys, so I guess now all of a sudden he gets credit for being an innovator. Jerry Lawler introduced the living legend Bruno Sammartino to the live crowd for a birthday sing-along on the app. His very first appearance ever on Monday Night Raw, and unfortunately they relegated it to the app. But it was a very nice thing for them to do. I did not get a birthday sing-along like Bruno did. I'm a little upset, I will say. Natalya, Eva Marie, and JoJo beat Oksana, Alicia Fox, and Rosa Mendez. After Natalya tapped Alicia out in the sharpshooter, Diva Stopwatch had this at 3 minutes 19 seconds. JoJo never even tagged into the match, and when Eva Marie was in there, as Jim Ross would say, it was bowling shoe ugly. And Eva is a beautiful woman. There's very little about her that's ugly aside from her wrestling ability. Only in WWE can you take a woman that beautiful and make her unappealing. We had Brad Maddox come out to apologize for the shitty finish the night before. So it was such a shitty finish, they've now incorporated it into the storyline. He made Bryan vs. Orton for the title at Hell in a Cell and said that we, the universe, would get to pick the special referee from 3 Hall of Fame candidates. First up to campaign for the spot was Booker T. And that was a dangerous choice because just last month, the escaped mental patients of the WWE Universe, Funny Farm, voted Booker T the greatest world heavyweight champion of all time. And in theory, he should have won this in a landslide. Thankfully, that did not happen. Later on, Bob Backlund was introduced. Yes, Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino in the same arena in Pittsburgh. It felt like 1977 all over again. It's been a while since we've seen old Bob campaign for anything on Raw. Last time, it was for the office of the president back in the mid-90s. He screamed and he hollered and scared my cat right out of the room. Literally, my cat ran away. She was afraid of Mr. Backlund. He threatened to put Brian and Orton both in the cross-faced chicken wing. That sold me. I immediately went and voted for Backlund in the app. And I was not the only one. He got 32% of the vote. 32% to Booker T's 7%. That is hilarious. Unfortunately, it was not enough to overcome the 61% that Shawn Michaels got, so he'll be the referee at Hell in a Cell. He came out, he admitted that he helped train Daniel Bryan, but also counted Triple H as being his best friend, and so he has no allegiance one way or the other. It's a wash, so you can vote for him. He'll be impartial, he says. He's going to call it like he sees it, ignoring the fact, of course, that at WrestleMania in Miami, when he last officiated a Hell in a Cell match, he super kicked The Undertaker right in the face and nearly helped Triple H end the streak. I don't know that I would trust this man. I still think it should have been Bob Backlund. There is nobody who deserves to be locked inside a cell more than him, preferably a padded one. Los Matadores beat 3MB. El Torito hit a Hurricanrana off the top rope after the match on Heath Slater, who took the best bump of all time off this move. It was awesome. CM Punk and R-Truth beat Ryback and Curtis Axel after Truth pinned Axel to build to their Intercontinental title match on SmackDown, which Axel won, by the way. It's a pretty good match. Randy Orton pinned Kofi Kingston after an RKO. You know, I was thinking about this on Monday when I'm watching this match and I'm tweeting about this. I was inside Madison Square Garden when Kofi gave Orton the boom drop in the crowd all those years ago. It is insane to think that that was 4 years ago already. And here we are, and their positions have not changed at all. And that's too bad, because I think they missed the chance to really do something with Kofi back then. After the match, Daniel Bryan ran down to the ring like a madman. He attacked Randy Orton. He did a tope through the ropes, knocked Orton over the announce desk, went after him again. Agents had to come and pull Bryan off of him. This was awesome. This was the best crazed babyface beating I've seen in a long time. This is the Daniel Bryan that we should have seen the night after SummerSlam. Vicky introduced Ricardo Rodriguez as Alberto Del Rio's opponent. Then she revealed that at Hell in a Cell, he'll defend the world title against John Cena. Ricardo snuck up behind him, got the pin, and Del Rio destroyed him on the outside after the match. Put his arm in a chair, put him in the arm bar. Let me also just mention this about Rob Van Dam, because there's been a lot of reports from different websites on the internet, some that say Rob Van Dam is, you know, on bad terms with WWE, he didn't sign a new contract. That is not the case. RVD had a clause built into his contract where he would wrestle, I think, for the first 90 days or so, and then he gets a break because he's got outside projects and he can kind of recharge his batteries and not be on the road all the time. that's the deal that he made with Triple H. They made that deal one-on-one. I don't know that Vince McMahon was really involved in anything other than just signing off on the contract. So RVD is still technically with WWE. He's just taking a break. Apparently he can take as long as he wants. My guess would be we'll see him back around Royal Rumble time. I'm sure he'll want to be back in time for WrestleMania. So things are fine. He'll be back. It's up to him when he comes back. There's no new contract to be signed. He already has a contract, and he has some free time built into it, which, quite frankly, I think more guys in his position should have. And I think going forward, we're going to see more of this. I have people who email me sometimes and go, oh, should there be a wrestling offseason? I don't think a wrestling offseason would ever work. I mean, just for the fact alone that you probably have a USA Network that would balk at the idea. You know, what are you going to... We're not going to have wrestling on our network that we pay millions of dollars for 2-3 months at a time. I don't think they're going to go for that. And I think a better solution to the problem would be to have mandatory time off, mandatory vacations for the talent. You kind of rotate them out. So let's say if you have one big star like a CM Punk who's all banged up, but he's due for a vacation, right? It's set in advance that at this point in the year, you're going to have 3 weeks off, let's say. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. And you build your storylines around that, so him leaving doesn't interfere with anything, whether you do an injury angle or you just, you know, don't even say anything and just let him take a few weeks off TV. And as long as it doesn't overlap, so you don't have John Cena and CM Punk and Randy Orton out at the same time, you come up with a system to rotate guys out and give them a break. I think that's a system that would probably work out much better. That way you don't have to shut the whole company down for months at a time. And RVD, I think this kind of deal that he has is a sign going forward of things to come. I think there's going to be more guys who are kind of in the same position as him. They're not rookies. They've been around for a while. And you just kind of rotate those guys out or give them some mandatory time off, even if they don't want to take time off. You mandate. It'll be paid time off for these guys so that they can recharge their batteries, heal up, and then come back fresh. And they may come back fresh to TV storylines, too. It gets boring sometimes seeing these guys over and over again, especially when they don't have any meaningful direction. I think that's why a lot of people got so sick and tired of seeing Sheamus on TV. I mean, what the hell was Sheamus doing before he got hurt? Nothing. He was a man without a program. He wasn't, you know, feuding with anybody at the time. The only person he's really feuded with all year was Mark Henry. He was doing some stuff with the Rhodes Scholars, and nobody cared. That wasn't a real feud. If a guy like Sheamus, if you mandated that this guy get, you know, 3 weeks off and then he comes back and you've got a plan in mind for him, great. Maybe people wouldn't be so sick and tired of him. So I think going forward, that's the direction that, you know, they may be going in. Santino and Kali against the Real Americans. This was a rematch from the pay-per-view. We got the giant swing. Cesaro swinging the great Kali. So we got it for free on this show. One of the few bright spots on that Battleground pay-per-view that people, it doesn't justify the price tag, but people said, well, at least we got the big giant swing. That was one of the best parts of the show. And then they turned around and they gave it to us again the next night. So it's like, what's the point? What was the point of even, whatever. It's comical at this point. Cesaro got the pin. At least Kali didn't count his own fall this time like he did at the pay-per-view. He got pinned by Cesaro at Battleground. And you could see it, you could hear it. He counted his own fall. Didn't bother kicking out. He just counted like he was the second referee in there. At least he didn't do that on this show. And after the match, Jack Swagger, he jacked the midget at ringside, gave him to Antonio for a hornswoggle swing. Santino broke it up. The crowd was not pleased about it. I think midget swinging is probably second only to midget tossing in terms of entertainment. We were told that Miz was coming out for a Miz TV segment with himself. I can't wait to see that quarter hour number. Why don't they just put a big graphic up on the screen that says, change the channel now and do not return. Thankfully, before he could even get a word out, the Wyatt family arrived. Somehow Miz was trapped between Bray Wyatt in the aisle and Harper and Rowan who were in the ring. Somehow he managed to escape. He did brawl briefly in the aisle with Bray, but he got past him, and then they all just stared at each other from a distance. So I guess that's his next feud. You know, between this and the way they set up the Kofi match going into Battleground with Bray Wyatt, I guess the deal with them is they're just randomly going to tear through different guys on the roster. I've had people write into me about a Shield versus Wyatt's feud, and I'm not that hot on it unless they're turning one faction babyface. And I don't think either one should be turned yet, but I will say it would be very intriguing to have the Shield come out there, let's say one night cutting a promo, and suddenly the lights go out and out comes the Wyatt clan. that would make for an interesting segment, I think. Main event was Daniel Bryan, Cody Rhodes, and Goldust against The Shield. Triple H was at ringside to observe. Good match. Anytime Bryan and Seth Rollins are in the ring together, it's just a pleasure to watch. Largely because Seth Rollins takes these insane, exaggerated bumps that make it seem like he's been shot or something. I think he may have surpassed Dolph Ziggler as my favorite bump taker on the roster. The good guys won by DQ after Dean Ambrose brought a chair into the ring while Bryan had Seth Rollins in the Yes Lock. Triple H got on the mic and said, "We're not having another screwjob finish like we did last night." And he ordered the match to be restarted under no disqualification rules. Within seconds, Randy Orton came out of nowhere, laid out Bryan with an RKO, rolled him into the ring. Rollins got the pin. After the match, they beat up Bryan and Goldust some more, tease giving Goldust the triple powerbomb when the fired Big Show's music suddenly started playing. The dude has no job. He got kicked out of the building after the opening segment and is back both still in his tights and with his entrance music. It only makes sense if we find out Vince McMahon is the one pulling the strings here. He got into the ring, Shield attacked him, Triple H directed traffic. He kept yelling at them to just end this, finish this. Reminded me of him barking orders to Flair and Batista the night they dumped Orton from Evolution. Big Show did this great explosion spot where all the members of the Shield just went flying, and now Triple H was nose to nose, or should I say nose to peck, with Big Show. And then came the big payoff with Big Show winding back and knocking Triple H out cold. People cheered as the evil dictator had finally been silenced. Bryan stuck back into the ring, stood over Triple H's prone body. He led the crowd in a giant yes chant. A fine finish to this here Raw episode. WWE.com has been running a story about Triple H suffering a concussion as a result of the KO punch, and that Big Show could end up being arrested as a result. And speaking of concussions, there actually is a very real concussion to talk about from this past week. AJ Lee got sent home from Raw Monday night with symptoms of a concussion. Apparently, at the pay-per-view in her match, I guess, with Brie Bella, her head hit the turnbuckle at some point. I don't know how hard. Obviously, it was hard enough. She was suffering memory loss and other issues. So, no word on how long she'll be out for. I mean, Dolph Ziggler got kicked in the head by Jack Swagger back in May, I think it was, and had a pretty bad concussion, and he was gone for quite a few weeks. And then when he came back, he lost his championship. Hopefully the same thing doesn't happen to AJ. Michael P.S. Hayes was in the news this past week, supposedly suspended from WWE, although that's not what WWE says. WWE has put out a statement saying that Michael is taking a leave of absence for personal reasons, and that's all they said. The reports that initially came out indicated that he was suspended about 3 weeks ago. He's been gone about that long. Nobody's seen him behind the scenes. And the reason is, allegedly, he was found to be drinking, which is something that he was not permitted to do. He agreed not to drink in order to keep his job after the incident a few years ago where he used the N-word to Mark Henry. Mark Henry was very upset about this, reported it to management. Hayes got in trouble. There's another report out there, so I don't know which is more accurate than the other. It's obvious that drinking was probably involved in some way, shape, or form, but the other story is actually far worse, and that is that he was caught offering alcohol to Rosa Mendez. Rosa Mendez completed a stint in rehab recently, supposedly for issues related to alcohol. So if that is true, and that was reported actually by Court Bauer, who used to be a member of the WWE creative team and has some moles, I guess you would say, who still work there on the inside in creative. That's what he said on his show, that it was because he offered alcohol to Rosa Mendez, they found out about it, he got in trouble, and he was actually suspended. He's not just taking time off for personal reasons. So whichever you choose to believe, I mean, that story is a hell of a lot worse, and if he did that, he's a scumbag. So hopefully that is not the entire story here. But, yeah, Hayes is gone for now. And Hayes is a big part of the backstage makeup, the management structure in WWE. He's been a key member of creative now for many, many years. How responsible he is, how much of an influence he is for what we see on television from week to week, I don't know. There's so many talking heads involved in the creative process. They have, you know, this big team of creative people. And I think about the way that whole company is structured now. It's so corporate and it's so proper. And like back in the day, you know, when we were fans in the mid-90s and the late 90s, you had Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson, and like two or three other people. I could just picture them, you know, sitting in a room somewhere. you know, with papers all over the place, just figuring out, okay, for the next 6 months, here's what this guy's going to be doing, and here's going to be our main feuds, and having it all mapped out. And that was with, you know, you can count the number of people probably on one hand who had influence in that process. And then, you know, Russo came later on, he was writing the shows. Now you've got, like, an entire team. Do you really need an entire team of creative writers? Is that really necessary? I mean, if these guys have awesome ideas, I mean, that's one thing, but I can't really say that a lot of the ideas we see unfold on TV are awesome. I guess Vince has to approve them. That's how the whole process works. But it's always funny to me. They have an army of writers. Do you really need an army of writers? Is it really that hard to write an entertaining wrestling show with just three or four people? Then again, they have so much more TV now than they did back then. They have more TV now than ever before. And they have, you know, everyone's got to write a full script. I mean, maybe they need those people. It just seems kind of unnecessary to me. NXT this week from Full Sail University. This was the second to last taping, I believe, from the batch about a month ago. I think there's one more tape show, and then we'll have some new episodes that were taped down in Florida this past week. Antonio Cesaro opened the show, best match on the show, against Leo Kruger. So basically, heel versus heel match here, coming off their brawl last week where both guys wanted a shot at Bo Dallas and the Bo Dallas Invitational, and instead, they ended up fighting each other. So neither man got the shot. Crowd chanted, "Push Cesaro," loudly, early in the match. By the end, Kruger was basically being positioned as the babyface. He was kicking out of moves for near falls. Cesaro would come back at him with another, almost got the tap out and a chin lock. Kruger was spitting up all over himself like guys used to do in the mandible claw when Mankind first came into WWF. He fights his way out of it. Cesaro delivers a lariat, finishes him off with the neutralizer. Really good match, after which Cesaro, I guess, decided he's not done. He went to the top rope and came off the top with a knee right across Leo Kruger's throat. Referees came down to tend to him. I don't know if this was the start of a babyface turn for Kruger, but I doubt it's the end of this feud between him and Cesaro, and would not mind seeing them in the ring more. This was a good match. Charlotte defeated Santana Garrett. This is our first time seeing Santana here on this show. She worked for TNA before as part of Orlando Jordan's bisexual act that he was doing a few years ago. And she wrestled Brooke Tessmacher on that Knockouts Knockdown pay-per-view that TNA taped back in March. I think it just aired, only aired this month. No, I'm sorry, in September. Yeah, the pay-per-view aired in September for the first time. Apparently she's also roommates, or was roommates at one point in the last few years, with Larry Zbysko, of all people. You got to look at this one. This is a very attractive young woman, and she's rooming with the head of Larry Land over there, Zbysko. That's quite the odd pairing there. Apparently, Zbysko worked as a trainer at the place where she was training, so that's how they got to know each other. Beyond that, I don't know what the relationship was between them, but I don't want to know. Not really much to the match. Charlotte wins with her somersault cutter move that I'm pretty sure she botched, because it sure looked like there was a really awkward jump cut in there when she hit it. Summer Rae and Sasha Banks, who came down during this match to mockingly root for Charlotte, they got in the ring afterwards for a promo. They said that Paige is officially out, thanks to us. And no sooner does she say that than who should run down? Why? It's the women's champion, Paige. She gets beaten up. Emma runs down to make the save. All the heels head for higher ground. And next week we find out it's going to be Summer Rae and Sasha against Paige and Emma. We got the in-ring debut of Mojo Rawley. He's the big guy who's full of hype. That's his gimmick, I guess. That's his shtick. He comes out, he's like, you gotta stay hype to be hype. And actually, he is a former defensive tackle who got signed by the Packers and ended his very brief career in the NFL with the Cardinals. Did you know that while he was with the Cardinals, his coaches and teammates called him the Iron Sheik because of how strong he was? That is true. They said he was the strongest player on the team. Just like Sheiky Baby back in the day. He used to swing those Persian clubs around. That's all well and good. He's going to need more than just strength to stand out if he's ever going to make it to the main roster. We already have the world's strongest man in Mark Henry and an absolute freak in Antonio Cesaro. So I think those guys have the strength thing pretty much covered. He does have a certain charisma about him. He comes down like a bat out of hell. He's slapping hands with the fans, telling them to stay hyped. What I found a bit odd about him is his obsession with using his ass to attack his opponent. He actually used Naomi's rear view on his opponent. Danny Burch was the name of his opponent. Poor Danny Burch. Got an ass full of hype here. Actually, I should give credit to Goldust and Rikishi before Naomi. Both of those guys used to use their backsides as offensive maneuvers. Offensive in more ways than one, by the way. He won the match with Earthquake's old seated splash, which does not seem nearly as effective when you're not 400 pounds like Earthquake used to be. So we'll see. We'll see about this guy. Apparently Triple H is high on him. I think I can kind of tell why. I think that's obvious. He's got personality, though, so that's a plus. Scott Dawson and Alexander Rusev, the Bulgarian brute, beat Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. Rusev used a camel clutch for the win on Enzo, then locked Big Kaz in the same move post-match. Don't really have anything else to say about this. It was fine. Backstage, Renee Young interviewed Sami Zayn. There is definitely some underlying sexual tension between these two. You know, it's like Renee gets those, like, fuck me eyes anytime she's around old Sammy. Last time I saw a diva get those eyes around another wrestler, it was Maryse on Raw, staring down The Miz. And now they're getting married next year. Miz was also speaking to her in French during that segment, and in fairness, speaking French to a woman is a surefire way to get her in bed. Or so I'm told. It's too bad I studied Italian. Bo Dallas shows up to tell Sammy how disappointed he is over what he did last week, dressing up in a mask to beat him and get a title match against him next week. He said, rather than fight each other, why don't we become a tag team? Let's go for the tag team titles. And Sammy thought this was a fabulous idea right after I beat you for the NXT title next week. And with that, he walked off, leaving Bo Dallas to remark that he finds this unbelievable. He's growing on me, I will say. He's terrible on the mic, but in little doses like that, he's growing on me, like a fungus, this guy. Aiden English, the artiste, comes out singing a new song. It is equally as great as the last one he sang. Ricardo Rodriguez comes out to introduce Rob Van Dam, who gets a superstar reaction in the NXT arena. They had a brief match. It was the first time we've seen Aiden English in a competitive match since his character overhaul. He was definitely the heel this week, so I don't think there's any question now what he's supposed to be. Van Dam won with the 5-star frog splash. Next week, it is the Divas tag match that I mentioned earlier, and the NXT title will be on the line. Bo Dallas defends against Sami Zayn. By the way, since being named the new GM of NXT, it's been 2 weeks, and JBL has made exactly zero appearances on the show. And I'm okay with that. To me, that's old school. You know, Jack Tunney would rarely make appearances on TV unless he had to, but they should really acknowledge JBL at some point, like a decision that he rendered or a big match that he made or just something. They just taped the next 4 episodes of NXT on Thursday night, and I think that will begin airing after next week's show. And I don't read the spoilers, but I did see that Tenzai did commentary for some of the episodes. If you listen to my Battleground review on YouTube, I specifically singled out Tenzai's performance as an analyst on their pre-show. I thought he was awesome. He looked the part, very articulate. He's got this booming voice. I was very impressed. And so here he is being brought in as a commentator on NXT. I'm not surprised at all. They obviously noticed the same thing I did and felt the same way. So now it's time for the Impact Report. Impact was live on Thursday night from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I thought Impact was actually good this week. Maybe even quite good. I enjoyed most of it. That still will not please the TNA diehards, who, if you say even one bad word, if you dare say one bad word about TNA, it makes you a WWE shill. So, in that case, welcome to Shillville, people. Dixie Carter opened the show with a promo, said she didn't need anybody telling her how to run her wrestling company. Not Vince, I think she meant Russo, which is comical to me, given how fiercely, ridiculously, stupidly loyal she was to that guy for so many years. She was the reason that he held on to that position a lot longer than he probably should have. She said, not Eric Bischoff, not Mr. Stephanie Levesque, not even those good old boy Jarretts. It is interesting how here in the year 2013, we have two female authority figures calling the shots on television for the two biggest wrestling companies. And behind the scenes, too. Dixie is the president of TNA. Stephanie very much has a leadership role in her company. I think that's great. I think it breaks up the good old boys network that traditionally has dominated pro wrestling. I just had to mention that. I hadn't really noticed it until now. Now, having said that, what the hell was the point of even mentioning Stephanie by name? Someone on Twitter said, in defense of this show, because again, they get very butthurt the minute you say something negative about TNA, because that's not allowed. And somebody said, well, she's just getting attention. What's wrong with that? Yeah, she's getting attention. She's getting the wrong kind of attention. I hate it. I hate it when they bring up WWE on this show because it reminds people, hey, we're second rate. I mean, someone like a Kurt Angle or a Jeff Hardy briefly mentioning their time in WWE, if they're referencing it during a promo, if it makes sense in the context of what they're talking about, that's fine. I mean, I guess I'm okay with that. But I just hate it when they do shit like this. You know, look at all the authority figures in storyline and in real life TNA has gone through over the years. Why not just stick to those people? Why can't Dixie just rattle off all those names? Nobody's going to tell me how to run my wrestling company. Not Jeff Jarrett or his daddy, not Eric Bischoff, not Sting, not even the immortal Hulk Hogan himself. Not even Mr. Stephanie McMahon. When has Triple H or Stephanie ever offered advice to Dixie? What do they have to do with anything? So that irritated me. Moving on, she said that she had given Bully Ray the authority to put his Bound for Glory opponent, AJ Styles, in any kind of match he wanted. And Sting came out, or should I say Steve, as she called him. I'm actually okay with that, since he didn't have the face paint on. He really does look like a real estate salesman without it. There's actually a funny story behind that, and it's been around the internet for a while now, that several years ago, when former UFC fighter Frank Trigg was brought in to do some stuff for TNA, so this goes back a number of years, he was backstage at a TNA show one time, and he spotted a guy that he knew from his gym that people called Real Estate Steve because he owned a lot of property, I guess, in the area, and he couldn't figure out what the hell Real Estate Steve was doing backstage at a TNA event, and he figured maybe he's just selling some property or something. And it wasn't until after he saw him with the face paint on a little while later that he realized, oh shit, you know, Real Estate Steve is actually Sting. So he certainly looks the part, either that or a car salesman. Dixie blamed him for recommending Hogan as the general manager and for going ahead and booking his own match with Magnus for Bound for Glory, I guess, without consulting her. This bothered her. She said, tonight, Sting would team up with Magnus against Bad Influence, and if either man lost, they would not be at Bound for Glory. And I cringed through most of this promo. She was speeding through it like a freight train, so she's got to learn to just slow it down a little bit. I will say, though, she got a ton of heat from the crowd throughout this segment. I thought maybe they had a recording on a loop of people booing. It was so consistent throughout. But no, I mean, the crowd really was booing her out of the building, so that's a positive sign, right? That's a positive sign to look towards. But for the love of God, do not mention the McMahons or WWE anymore, okay? Unless it's to announce an acquisition. They should never be mentioned. Austin Aries beat Jeff Hardy with a brainbuster off the top rope. A sick, sick-looking finish and a clean win for Aries. The announcers really played it up as a shocking thing, him pinning Jeff Hardy. Hardy looked like he landed right on top of his head, which I guess is the point of the move, but I can't help it. I worry when I see stuff like that. This was easily the best match on the entire show. A good showcase for what fans can expect in Ultimate X at Bound for Glory. After the match, Samoa Joe made his way out and he announced that he too would be part of the Ultimate X match at the pay-per-view. I guess they dropped the weight limit they had for the X division, unless they're going by Joe's weight in space, perhaps. But it's nice to see them put a renewed focus on the X division. That's really what brought them to the dance all those years ago. And finally, they're giving some attention to it and putting some big names in there to get people to care. ODB beat Jesse Godders by DQ. We had Lay DiTapa come out after the match and just destroy ODB. Held up ODB's Knockouts title. She's not currently in the title match at the pay-per-view, but I suppose they could add her at the last minute or just feud her with the champion, maybe coming out of the pay-per-view, whoever that is, probably ODB. She hasn't even wrestled her debut match yet, and she's already going to challenge for the title. It's completely messed up. But who else do they have? You know, the Knockouts division has been completely decimated. I mentioned a few months ago that Taryn Terrell, the reason Taryn Terrell has not been seen, was it was being reported that she was pregnant. And this week came the official word from Taryn Terrell herself that she is, in fact, pregnant. I think she's having a baby girl soon. So she's been gone for a while. Tara, they fired. Mickey James, for now anyway, is gone. Velvet Sky, I guess Velvet Sky's doing her thing now with Chris Sabin. Velvet Sky is not exactly I wouldn't call her the best wrestler by any stretch on the Knockouts roster. They don't have a lot of girls, so when you have that problem, you'll have somebody who hasn't even wrestled the match yet, who all of a sudden is in contention for the championship. They've got to push somebody. She's as good as anybody, I guess. Backstage, Nux and Garrett Bischoff were pissed about Aces and Eights being down to only three members. I laughed out loud. Taz sits there at ringside every single week with that vest on, but he is such a non-factor, they don't even count him as a member of this group anymore. Bully blamed everything on Mr. Anderson, which the fact that he was name-dropping Anderson left and right here, I think all but guarantees Anderson has signed a new deal to return. It's just a matter of when he'll pop up on TV. Maybe at Bound for Glory. Ray said that tonight he was putting Nux and Bischoff in a handicap match against AJ Styles and giving them the chance to prove themselves. Up next was a really fun segment. It was Daniels and Kazarian inducting Bobby Roode into the Ego Hall of Fame, making him the second member behind Hulk Hogan. Daniels and Kaz came out dressed in these orange and blue tuxedos with top hats looking like Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels in Dumb and Dumber, which coincidentally would make for a great subtitle to that Death of TNA book with the shot of Dixie hugging Hogan's leg on the cover. I swear that's the last crack I'm going to make about that, okay? I promise. I promise. Kazarian introduced Bobby Roode, introducing him as a man who once got busy in a Tim Hortons bathroom. They had this giant chair. It was more like a throne in the ring for Roode to sit in. Then they aired a special video montage that Kazarian supposedly worked on himself. I slaved over a hot computer, he said. This was fantastic stuff. They had baby photos with Bobby Roode's head stuck on them, beard and everything. They had footage of Hardy and Aries and AJ Styles. I don't know what DVD it was from, but they dubbed over part of the audio so that whenever they said something complimentary, all you heard was Bobby Roode. It was like watching a Japanese movie with subtitles where their lips are moving, but it's not matching the audio. This was great. Roode then gave his induction speech. He cut a promo on Kurt Angle, angry that Kurt was being inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame, saying he didn't deserve it. Conveniently enough, after being gone for 2 months, out comes the man himself, Kurt Angle, looking as big and muscular as I've seen him probably in years. He suplexed Daniels, he dropped Kazarian right on his head. Angle said he would face Roode at Bound for Glory, which would be a rematch, actually, of the Bound for Glory main event 2 years ago. So there's another match set up for the pay-per-view in a couple of weeks, and hopefully Kurt is in a better position now and a better place in his life than he was 2 months ago. You know, he didn't spend that much time in rehab, and he's right back to wrestling now. And like I said, hopefully he's got his life back in order and he's not a menace to others on the road anymore. Brooke Tessmacher beat Velvet Sky to earn the third spot in the Knockouts three-way at Bound for Glory. She will join ODB and Gail Kim. Velvet had her ribs all taped up from last week's attack by Lady Tapa. Chris Sabin is so much more entertaining in this role as a heel right now than as a babyface. It's not even funny. He comes out with Velvet looking exactly like Brian Pillman circa 1995 when he was with the Four Horsemen. The hair, the vest, the glasses, the mannerisms. He's probably about the same height, too, as Pillman. Small guy. I said last week that Sabin was giving me a Pillman vibe. This week, he was like a clone. He covered up Velvet when she went to show off her ass during her entrance, and then he distracted her and accidentally caused her to lose the match. He seemed to be teasing a breakup already between the two of them, which makes perfect sense since they've been together on TV for all of, what, 3 weeks, maybe? They aired the same vignette from last week for Derek Bateman's new Ethan character, who's now being billed as Ethan Carter III, or EC3 for short. I like that a lot. EC3 is going to be an easy thing for people to chant when they turn him babyface later on in his career. You always want to pick a name that's easy to chant. You know, that's why Michael McGillicuddy was such an utter and complete failure. One of the many reasons, I should say. I wonder if the idea is that he's related to Dixie in some way. Maybe he's her nephew or something. It could be an easy way to get him heat right out of the gate. Sting and Magnus beat Bad Influence, worth noting that they came out to Sting's entrance music. So between Kurt Angle doing his own thing and now Joe doing his, although Joe was wearing a suit earlier in the show, but I get the impression the Main Event Mafia might be a thing of the past. If it isn't, it probably will be after the pay-per-view if Magnus turns on Sting, which I'm sure is coming at some point. They teased dissension between them at times during the match. Magnus was very upset when Sting got the pin on Kazarian and not him. They argued. Trouble. Trouble is brewing. Dixie confronted AJ backstage. She said he didn't have to wrestle tonight. She offered him a check for more money than he's ever held in his hands before. She said, think of all the good you can do down in your community of trailer parks in Gainesville, Georgia. He could start a foundation for all the little redneck kids who can't read. Okay, That was a great line, I have to say. She was quite great with that line. Styles teased taking the money, then he ripped up the check, threw it in her face. And as AJ walks off, she says, well, I didn't sign the check anyway. See, I think I enjoy heel Dixie more in small doses like this than in rambling in-ring promos. Still, let's recap this here for a moment if we can. She basically wanted to pay AJ Styles a shit ton of money just to retire and to go away. Why would she do that? I'm not even going to make a joke about how the company has no money to waste like that, because in storyline, that's not the case. In storyline, Dixie's got money trees growing in her backyard, right? Her and her family. But why pay the guy to retire when he's not even under contract? This is not nitpicking, people. This is a valid question. Main event was AJ Styles against Nux and Bischoff. Bully was on commentary with Taz. They chased away Mike Tenay. I wish they would do that more often. Styles won after some sort of botched roll-up on Bischoff. I'm sure Bischoff fucked up, not Styles. They all attacked AJ after the match. Bully started whipping him with a chain. He yelled at Nux and Bischoff for being losers. Styles tried to fight back, but he got backdropped on the ramp and was left laying to end the show. I liked Impact. I can't say that Bound for Glory feels like all that big of a deal, even though it's their biggest show of the year, supposedly, and their first pay-per-view since June. I mean, that was one of the whole points of eliminating all those other pay-per-view shows. A, they weren't doing any business, but B, the hope was that by only having, let's say, four pay-per-views a year, those four would feel more special. Not only is this one of the four, this is supposedly the WrestleMania of TNA. And I don't really think it feels all that special right now. They got one more week, it's a tape show, then the pay-per-view October 20th out in San Diego. We'll see. I took a look at the results for next week, and there's nothing that really jumps out at me, but we'll see how it plays out. Hulk Hogan, who quit TNA on television last week, he was interviewed by the Associated Press, which said Hogan might be one of the hottest free agents in sports. Yes, in all of sports. Talked about his decision whether or not he would return to WWE or return to TNA. He's a man being pulled in both directions right now. He doesn't know what to do. And on TNA, he said, we just couldn't figure things out. We're still talking, but it's wide open, he said. He also claimed that he actually met with Triple H at a charity event recently. He said, Triple H just welcomed me with open arms. He said, if I ever decide I get the itch to come back home, the door is wide open. And since I can't ever believe a word out of Hulk Hogan's mouth, I don't even know that he really did meet Triple H at a charity event. Maybe he did. But Hogan's one of those guys, how can you ever believe anything that comes out of the man's mouth? And I don't think Triple H is really a huge fan of Hulk Hogan either, if stories over the years are any indication. I don't think he's the biggest Hulk Hogan fan, but I think Triple H is the guy who, even if he wasn't a big Hogan fan, would be willing to put that aside if they felt they could bring Hogan back and make money off him. So, color me skeptical. On a final match, Hogan said, let me put it to you this way, brother. With the right guy, the right situation, big enough event, big enough storyline, you're damn right I have one more match left in me. And that's probably true. But let's be clear on what a match really is here. What could Hulk Hogan physically do in the ring? Other than throw a punch. Maybe Irish whip somebody into the ropes for a punch. I was going to say a boot, but he can't even do that anymore. Hulk Hogan can't do anything in the ring anymore. If Hulk Hogan could wrestle, he would have at least been able to do some sort of tag team match in TNA, and he couldn't even do that. There was a story like a month ago. Hogan was up in Canada. I think it was with the mayor of Toronto or something, and maybe it was a charity event, and they had like an arm wrestling contest. And I remember reading that Hogan made it clear to people beforehand, because I think they wanted to do something like a fun thing where somebody would come up from behind Hogan and grab him and, you know, try to get him to lose the match. And I think Hogan told them in advance, like, I can't even do that. Like, I can't even have anybody come up behind me, grabbing me and touching me because I got a bad back. I mean, if you can't even do that with Hogan, how the hell is the guy going to get through an actual match? I mean, you talk about all the gimmicks and the interference or smoke and mirrors, whatever you want to call it, that you'd have to have. He'd have to be in there with like a Heath Slater or somebody like that who can just run into Hogan and bounce off him and take these awesome bumps. If you have the right opponent for him, sure, I think Hogan could probably still draw in a big match at WrestleMania. I just don't know who that is. There's people online saying, oh, we'll have Hogan Undertaker with the streak on the line. That is a horrible idea. Absolutely terrible. And can you imagine if Hogan decided, I'm going to exercise my 100% creative control, I'm going over, I'm ending the streak? Can you imagine the shitstorm at the last minute that would create? But that's not a match that needs to happen. The last time we saw Hogan Undertaker in the ring together for a match was over a decade ago. Think about that. Over 10 years ago, when Undertaker beat Hogan to win the Undisputed Belt at that Judgment Day pay-per-view, that was a terrible match, and that was 11 years ago. Imagine the kind of match those two would have today. That is not a good idea, people. So I'm racking my brain trying to figure out who this right opponent or right situation would be that Hogan talks about. I suppose you could do it with like a lower level guy, and it would literally be them taking a bump off Hogan. Hogan would just have to stand there and not do much of anything. It's not like he can give the leg drop anymore or anything like that. I don't know what that match would be. He talks about issues with his last run in WWE. He says, maybe my ego was in the way. That is a funny comment right there. I laughed uproariously when I read that the first time. Maybe his ego was in the way. He said, even though I passed the torch to The Rock, I kept feeling there was more gas in the tank. Maybe I couldn't see what everybody else saw. Maybe I was going to go out there and embarrass myself when I wrestled The Rock. I don't know. I just wanted something different for the character. Well, his run with The Rock wasn't exactly his last run in WWE, but whatever. On his future, he says, I owe it to the fans that have been loyal to me for 35 years for this Hulkamania thing, and probably, you know, it won't end. It will probably go on forever after I'm dead and gone. But what's the logical extension, he says? What's the right direction right now? I owe it to them to make the right choice. Yes, he owes it to the fans. Has nothing at all to do with the money and everything to do with the Hulkamaniacs. That's really what matters. Finally, he says, in reference to all those years of him using the leg drop as his finishing move and just completely wrecking his body, he said he's had hip and knee replacements and multiple back surgeries. And this is a quote from Hulk here. He says, what an idiot to say that I had the largest arms in the world, and yet I jump up and land on my tailbone every single night. Somebody needs to forward a link to this interview to Fandango on Twitter. Please, send him a link to this, because this is something he needs to read. This guy's coming off the top rope doing a leg drop every night. And he looks great. He looks great doing it. But here's Hulk Hogan, who people would mock and criticize for years about, you know, he had five moves, he wouldn't do much, which, again, wasn't true if you watch Hogan in Japan. Hogan was actually a pretty good wrestler. But yeah, Hogan did the bare minimum. Once he took off and became this big star, Hulkamania running wild, he knew he could get away with doing the bare minimum. He can flex, he could pose, and all he would have to do is the big boot, the leg drop, slam some fat guys, and people would go crazy for him. And yet, all these years later, Hogan's body is falling apart. So what do you think is going to happen to all these other guys that have these crazy, insane moves, or a guy like Fandango doing the same move, landing on his tailbone, only he's landing on his tailbone from 10 feet up instead of 5? It's time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please send in audio questions as well, MP3 format only. You can email me with the audio attached, and also please include the question in written form in the body of your email. This first note here I want to mention. Last week, I talked about Susan G. Komen and cancer charities and, you know, things to look out for and why, you know, I don't donate anything to Komen. And asked you guys if there's any organizations that you use or that you've donated to that you think are worthwhile, where the money is going to what it should be going to, email me and let me know. I want to just read this one comment here. This came from Bill. He says, I donate to St. Jude's Children Research often. I have donated to them for a few years now, and the reason I do so is because I like the idea of kids getting treatment for their various cancer-related illnesses, regardless of a parent's inability to pay. I've never had a negative experience with them, nor have I heard anything negative about their organization except their infomercial, which can be completely insufferable to sit through. So this one that Bill wrote in about is not so much about breast cancer as it is about children's cancer in general, but still a worthwhile recommendation from Bill, and I wanted to mention that here on the air. You can visit stjude.org, that's stjude.org. to make a donation and to read up on what they're all about if that's what you're interested in. This guy says, my name is Chris. I'm a big fan of the show. Do you know what WCW's plans were for the Big Bang pay-per-view that never happened? There was an ad in the April 2001 issue of WCW Magazine for a pay-per-view in May called The Big Bang. Scott Steiner had been built up as an unstoppable monster by mowing through all the top faces in the company like Sting, Booker T, Kevin Nash, DDP. In addition, Goldberg's career had been ended in storyline by Totally Buff. I heard a rumor that the main event for Starrcade, if it had ever taken place later that year, would have been Scott Steiner defending against Goldberg for the championship. Do you have any information on this? Has anybody ever commented on what their plans were? And Chris actually included a photo of the advertisement in question here in his email. This is a real ad. There really were plans for a Big Bang pay-per-view. It was going to be the official relaunch of WCW, of the brand, under Eric Bischoff and Fusion Partners. This was when Bischoff thought the company would be his. He had investors. He had already devised a plan for the company to essentially go dark for several weeks. So they were, it's almost like they were going to shut down. There would be no WCW television for a little while, and then they would start all over again. Hence the Big Bang name for the pay-per-view. It was to be the rebirth of World Championship Wrestling. That is, until Turner canceled their TV slots and Fusion backed out. Without TV, the company was essentially worthless, according to Eric Bischoff. And Bischoff appeared on Nitro in those waning weeks. He made, I believe, two different appearances on back-to-back weeks on Monday Nitro via telephone. They had a phone call that they aired with Bischoff. And I couldn't find the audio of the first phone call, nor do I remember this episode, but apparently it happened where Bischoff called in and Bischoff was explaining what the plans are, that he either had purchased or would be purchasing WCW. He had partners. They were going to turn this company around. He was very excited for it. And then the very next week, they had Bischoff back on via phone. And this actually was the, I guess you would say, the penultimate edition of Monday Nitro, the second to last edition. And he sounded completely down in the dumps. There was no excitement in his voice at all. There were certain developments over the course of that week that changed everything. It just completely changed the trajectory of where WCW, he thought, was headed. He thought he basically had it lock, stock, and barrel. And as it turns out, that was not the case. And he practically sounded like a defeated man on television.
For those of you in the arena and all of you watching around the country this evening, I very much would have chosen to be there tonight in person if I could be, but given everything that's going on tonight, that's just not possible. Many of you may know that for the past 6 months I've been working with a group of people whose goal it was and is to acquire World Championship Wrestling and to grow it once again to become a competitive, dominant wrestling organization worldwide. But recently we've hit a couple roadblocks that may be, in fact, brick walls. And while it is still in my power, I want to do something befitting what could be very well the last night of wrestling on the Turner networks.
I don't know what the specific plans were for the Big Bang pay-per-view itself, but again, that would have been the relaunch after a short dark period of the WCW brand under Eric Bischoff, provided they still had TV on Turner, which at that point they didn't. And when that went away, the partners backed out. Vince McMahon swooped in, got WCW on a sweetheart deal. He basically picked the bones, picked up some contracts, got the tape library, a lot of the copyrights and trademarks and all that, and the rest is history. This comes from Gabe. I was wondering if you think WWE will have a three-team TLC match at December's TLC pay-per-view. I was thinking about how WWE is starting to restore some value in its tag team division and thought that an old-school TLC match like the ones the Hardys, Dudleys, and Edge and Christian used to have would bring excitement back to the division. Which three teams would you like to see if that were to happen? Personally, I would like to see the Usos, Real Americans, and of course the Shield, Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns. I would throw in Los Matadores in there too. Four teams, eight men. And you could do some crazy spots with El Torito. Tim Tapp writes in, congratulations on closing in on 300 episodes. What are your thoughts on the backstage group BSK? From what I understand, the group consisted of Undertaker, Yokozuna, Charles Wright, and I believe Crush as well. The initials are also on Undertaker's belly. They existed at the same time as the Click. I've read that they were something of a counterbalance to the Click when they got out of control. What do you think? I think all of those BSK guys got those same tattoos. It was like a solidarity thing, I guess. Undertaker's is on his stomach. BSK stood for Bone Street Crew, K-R-E-W. That was confirmed by Paul Bearer in an interview years ago. Kevin Nash talked about the group as well when he was on Steve Austin's podcast. I think Undertaker and Yokozuna were kind of like the leaders, and they had Godfather, Rikishi, Savio Vega, and the Godwins as members. I don't know about Crush. I know Crush and Undertaker were good friends behind the scenes. I don't really remember ever hearing his name mentioned as part of that group. Midian, Phineas Godwin at that time, did a shoot interview where he said the group was basically established to protect one another from the influence of the clique at the time. I think they all got along. There's that one... And when I say all of them, I mean them and the clique. It's not like they never interacted with the clique or they were enemies. There's this one famous photo on the back of a tour bus of all those guys sitting together drinking beer and smoking cigars. Well, Triple H isn't drinking because he doesn't drink, but he's in there. Kevin Nash, Shawn Michaels, Steve Austin, Jerry Briscoe. See, now that would have made for some great television, I think. You make the clique a formal group on TV. I mean, I guess by mid-96, Hall and Nash were gone. But with a little more foresight, right? You make the clique an actual group on TV, and they develop this rivalry against Biker Undertaker. If we had Biker Undertaker years before we actually got him, we'd have Biker Undertaker and his Bone Street crew. I think that actually would have been pretty cool to see. Marcus writes in, first off, according to WWE 2K14, the Ruthless Aggression era started at WrestleMania X8 and did not end until WrestleMania 24. When do you think the Ruthless Aggression era ended? And what goes through your mind when people like to call you a WWE biased mark? The Ruthless Aggression era didn't start at WrestleMania 18. Maybe they meant that it started after WrestleMania 18. Maybe you made a mistake, because that would be correct. I looked up the date. I remember the exact Raw show where Vince McMahon first used that phrase, and I had to look up the date, and it was June 24th, 2002, when he gave his Ruthless Aggression era, or rather I should say his Ruthless Aggression address to the roster. All the guys were surrounding the ring. That era, to me, it ended when Chris Benoit killed himself and killed his family. And the next year, we got the start of the PG era in 2008. As far as people who say, oh, you know, what a WWE mark you are, you're so biased and all that jazz, I find it mostly comes from some people watching my clips on TV tracks on YouTube who don't bother listening to the full shows or who didn't bother listening to my Battleground review on YouTube, because if they did, they'd never be able to say that with a straight face. Okay, they hear one snippet of me criticizing TNA or a funny joke that I make at TNA's expense. And I admit, I make jokes at their expense, just like I sometimes make jokes at WWE's expense, too. But it's harder for me to make business jokes about WWE when they're making money hand over fist, even in a bad year, and TNA is practically out of money. It's a big difference there. But they hear these snippets of me, you know, criticizing TNA, and they get their undies in a bunch. You know, listen to the full shows, and you'll know that I'm a hell of a lot more even-handed when it comes to my analysis of these shows. It'd be like reading the first four chapters of a book and ignoring the other 24. I don't take these people seriously. Brian writes in, what do you think is the most overrated match of all time? One that comes to mind for me would be the Hogan-Andre match at WrestleMania 3. I think that match was more of a spectacle than anything else. I've watched the match several times throughout the years, and it seems to get more boring every time I see it. Just very slow pace, nothing really exciting about it. What do you think? I agree on the Hogan-Andre thing being more of a spectacle. And really, you could say the same thing about Hulk Hogan and The Rock at WrestleMania 18, which is one of my favorite all-time WrestleMania matches. You know, the crowd is what made that match. I'm not, you know, foolish enough to think otherwise. You put that match with the Hulk up and everything in front of a dead crowd, and you've got a snoozer. So in that case, the crowd made all the difference. And, you know, this may piss some people off, but I have always seen a lot of praise from fans, and WWE loves to make it out to be a hell of a lot more than it was, because that's what WWE does. But I would go ahead and put the first Iron Man match on that list as well, between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12. If I made a list of great Bret Hart matches, and I made a list of great Shawn Michaels matches, that match wouldn't even make it into my top 10 for either one of those guys. Okay, I know they were trying to tell a story with how slow-paced it was and all that stuff. And the match had its moments. There were some spectacular moments during that match. Shawn Michaels diving outside the ring and the moonsault and everything else. It wasn't a bad match, but by no means was it this all-time classic, you know, that people make it out to be. It's not even the best Iron Man match. I thought the Rock vs. Triple H Iron Man match at Judgment Day in 2000 was a much more entertaining match than that one. It was all action. I mean, I like wrestling as much as the next guy, but there were plenty of times I was so bored during the Bret vs. Shawn match. I was never bored once during the Rock vs. Triple H match. You know, one of my criteria, and you'll have your own, right? It's a subjective thing. This is not fact. It's my opinion. One of my criteria is, can I go back and watch the match again now and be entertained? Is there a replay value with that match? For me, there is no replay value in Bret vs. Shawn from WrestleMania 12. That first ladder match from WrestleMania 10 with Shawn and Razor Ramon, some people might say that match is overrated. And maybe it is. Maybe it is a little bit. But I can still go back and watch that match from start to finish and not be bored. Not for a second. It holds up well even today, even though they had a better match at SummerSlam the year after that. So I would go with that one. I would go with the Iron Man match. And if I had to pick one more, and I was there live for this match, I think that first Rock versus John Cena match in Miami is overrated by some people. I shouldn't say everybody, because some people didn't like the match. But I see enough praise for it where, you know, it was good, but Rock looked gassed midway through the match, and it didn't live up to that year-long hype for it. I don't know that anything could have. You hype something up for an entire 12 months, and you give them a match that maybe is good or pretty good at best, and there's going to be some disappointment there. And again, I know WWE will make it sound like it was the biggest battle of the current generation, and they were two of the biggest stars, but that doesn't mean you're going to end up with a great match. And, you know, it was a great moment in the stadium live. Place went nuts when Rock won. But it wasn't even the best match on that show. And the match this year in New Jersey was even worse. So let me know what you guys think. Let's stick to WWE on this one. What do you think are the most underrated and overrated matches in WWE history? And why? Explain why. Brian also wants to know, what other shows do you like other than pro wrestling? Are you a big football guy or maybe MMA, UFC? I wouldn't say I'm a big football or MMA guy. I'm a casual fan. I'm more of a baseball fan than any other sport if I had to pick one. I'm a huge fan of The Walking Dead. I think a lot of you guys know that already, which is back tonight, by the way. I'm very excited about that. I'm not planning on doing reviews again for the Layfield Report. I'm sure somebody else will probably pick up on that. It's just I just can't do it again this time. But I'm very much looking forward to the return of that show. I love Wipeout. I think it's the funniest show on television, even though it's technically a game show. I don't care. It doesn't matter. I really don't watch much television other than that, to be honest with you. A lot of the shows that I love, like dramas and stuff on cable, are over now. The Shield is probably still my all-time favorite show. And you know, The Sopranos, I watched a whole bunch of those shows. I am about to start on a Netflix show that I've heard a lot of good things about called Orange is the New Black. I thought it was about Taz at first, but it's not. I'm looking forward to that one, but really, that's pretty much it. I mean, if you have any shows you want to recommend that you think are worth a watch, let me know, and maybe I'll check them out. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, 21 years ago, on October 12, 1992, Bret the Hitman Hart beat the Nature Boy Ric Flair at a house show in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada, to win his first WWE championship. Vince McMahon was in the middle of it was a period of transition, really, for his company. He was looking for somebody that did not look like a gigantic, roided-up monster to be his champion. And Ric Flair certainly did not fit that bill either. He didn't look big and jacked up, but Flair was part of that old guard, and Vince was looking to get a fresh, young, new name in there. And that's why they rushed the belt onto him. Flair had just beaten Randy Savage like a month and a half earlier, also at a live event, although I think they did air that on television, to take the title back from Macho Man Randy Savage. And here we are, it was like 5 or 6 weeks later, and he drops the title to Bret at a non-televised event. So obviously it was a very sudden thing. In fact, I think the only time that match aired anywhere was on an old Coliseum video release called Smack 'em Whack 'em. And I know this because I actually still have the video here somewhere. I own a copy. So that was kind of the story behind it. And at that time, there were guys that had gotten fired. I don't know if they were fired before Brett won the belt or if it was a few weeks later. But going into that Survivor Series pay-per-view the next month, you know, Ultimate Warrior was going to be in the main event. He was going to be headlining with Randy Savage against Flair and Razor Ramon. Warrior got fired because I think they discovered or were tipped off that he was importing growth hormone or something from overseas. They got very, very serious, WWF did at that time, with their steroid and drug policy. Probably the most serious they've been up until the current incarnation of the wellness policy. They weren't playing around. So they actually got rid of the Warrior. They got rid of Davey Boy Smith. And think about that. British Bulldog was the Intercontinental Champion at that time. And he was also supposed to defend the title, I think, against the Mountie at Survivor Series. He had just pinned Bret Hart in the main event, the final match of that SummerSlam show in Wembley Stadium in front of their biggest crowd of all time. And they fired the guy. You know, 2 months later, he was fired. Or 2.5 months, whatever it was. They were pretty serious about things. So Bret was the benefactor from all that. He won the championship here for that reason. 15 years ago this week, on October 12th, 1998, Monday Night Raw from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, New York. I was at this show. It was only my second Raw show ever. And a lot of things happened on this show. This was the show where Stone Cold filled Vince McMahon's old Corvette with, as Jim Ross would call it, cement. Sounded like semen when he first said it, which is kind of gross. Triple H was stripped of his Intercontinental title due to a knee injury he suffered against The Rock in that ladder match at SummerSlam. So they had a tournament. Ken Shamrock beat X-Pac in the finals to become the new Intercontinental Champion. Mankind on this show debuted the Mr. Socko Mandible Claw in his match against Mark Henry. And the main event had Rock and Stone Cold against Kane and The Undertaker with the return of the Big Boss Man. This was Boss Man's big comeback to WWE. First time since 1993 that he had appeared for the company as Vince McMahon's henchman, clad in a very Shield-esque flak jacket. So that was a pretty newsworthy show. 14 years ago this week, on October 10th, 1999, came the now infamous Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view, perhaps the worst pay-per-view in the history of professional wrestling. A man by the name of Bill Stone had an idea. He wanted to capitalize off wrestling's rocketing popularity. This was the height of the Attitude Era. This was 1999. And so his idea was that he would host a series of pay-per-views made up of big-time wrestling stars from the 1980s, maybe the early 90s. They never made it past the first show, largely because of the atrocity that was the main event on this one. It was scheduled to be a double main event of Jake the Snake Roberts against Jim the Anvil Neidhart and King Kong Bundy against Yokozuna. Yokozuna, who was beyond morbidly obese by this point. He was such a health hazard, WWE wouldn't touch him because many of the state athletic commissions wouldn't license the guy. And apparently they were right, since he died the year after this. Anyway, he wasn't the problem. The problem was Jake Roberts, who's doing much better these days thanks to Diamond Dallas Page. But back then, Jake was a wreck. He shows up for his pre-match promo completely wasted, either on drugs or booze or both. He was slurring his speech. Nothing he said made any sense. Just a complete embarrassment. Then came the match. This was only the appetizer to the entree, if you will. Jake comes down to the ring with his snake. He sits the bag down, then he stumbles back to the locker room. And a few moments later, he reappears, only this time he has no t-shirt on. And if you saw this, you would know what a horrific scene that was. He takes this lady's hands in the front row. He starts rubbing them on his nipples. He pulls the snake out of the bag. He sticks it between his legs. And he pretended it was his schlong. Neidhart has no idea what to make of this. When Jim Neidhart is the one standing there thinking to himself, what the fuck? You know you're truly messed up. The announcers start talking about random things in an effort to stall. Suddenly, out comes King Kong Bundy. He starts talking to Neidhart outside the ring. They gang up on Roberts. Yokozuna eventually comes out. And they announce that it's now a tag team match. So there's your audible. Whoever called it deserves praise. Jake was just stumbling all over the place. Finally, and this match went 16 minutes, by the way. Okay? Here's a pay-per-view main event where I don't think anybody would have complained if they cut, say, 15 minutes from it. Okay? After 16 minutes of this nonsense, Bundy pins Jake with a splash. The referee does a quick three count. I think Yokozuna was the legal man. It doesn't matter. Afterwards, some bald dude ran into the ring and got Samoan dropped by Yokozuna. And then Jake put his snake on top of the guy, and the show faded to black. And the most hilarious part is that if you watch the video on YouTube, they fade out, right? About 20 or 30 seconds go by, and they come back to the arena for one last shot with the logo on the bottom of the screen. And in the ring, you see Yokozuna standing in the corner, and Jake, who was upright when they faded out, is now laying down, passed out on the canvas. Zeb Coulter did color commentary for the show, if you can believe it, and the play-by-play guy, whose name I don't remember, and for his sake, he should be happy about that, because I wouldn't want to be associated with this crap either. At one point, the play-by-play guy referred to a drop kick as a leg drop. Just everything about this show was a complete and total failure. 12 years ago this week, on October 8th, 2001, Stone Cold Steve Austin beat Kurt Angle on Monday Night Raw to regain the WWF Championship that he had lost at the Unforgiven pay-per-view only a few weeks earlier. 7 years ago this week, on October 9, 2006, Kurt Angle made his debut appearance in the Impact Zone for TNA. Angle got in Samoa Joe's face. He headbutted him. The two of them brawled. The Angle-Joe matches that would come later on, namely the cage match that they had where Joe won the belt, they did some of the best business that TNA has ever seen. That cage match that they did on pay-per-view did 60,000 buys. God only knows what heel Dixie would get down on her knees and do these days to even come close to that kind of number. Angle got on the microphone after their little skirmish here. He said he wasn't fired from WWE, but rather he asked for his release and he got it. And think about how far gone, health-wise, Kurt Angle had to be at that point for them to let him go. One of their top stars, no strings attached, just let him go. He said Vince McMahon could kiss his Olympic ass. And these days, Kurt can't stop singing Vince McMahon's praises, and he keeps teasing about having one more match at WrestleMania. So hopefully he's cleaned himself up after his recent stint in rehab. 6 years ago this week, on October 8th, 2007, backstage at an OVW television taping in Louisville, which is where WWE was still running developmental at the time, there was a famous incident involving CM Punk and WWE Hall of Famer Tony Atlas. Atlas was there as something as a mentor to the talent there. He was supposed to be offering advice about how to avoid some of the bad habits he fell into during his own career. And instead, he spent his time criticizing and berating a lot of the wrestlers there, one of whom was CM Punk. He said Punk looked like he had two broken arms because of all the wrist tape he was wearing, which, of course, is just the way he looks when he performs. It's part of his getup. This was before the taping. Okay, Punk heard this. He didn't say anything. He went on his merry way to work. In the post-show meeting, Atlas went off. He just went off on how many of the wrestlers there had a bad attitude. And whenever he would make a negative comment, he would stare right at CM Punk. And so after this happened a few times, Punk decided enough of this crap. He spoke up. He asked Tony Atlas, why do you keep looking at me? And that was all it took to set off Tony Atlas. He blazed into CM Punk and said he would never make it to television, without realizing that Punk was already working on TV for WWE. In fact, Punk was on TV as the ECW champion at the time. And he also competed in the Money in the Bank ladder match that year at WrestleMania. I would have loved to have seen one of the other wrestlers in that meeting, just to see the look on their face. I doubt that I would have been able to keep a straight face after that comment. Punk asked him if he even watches the show, which of course Atlas didn't, or else he would have known not to make such a stupid comment. Of course, the irony is that the very next year, Atlas was brought in as part of the ECW brand as a heel to manage Mark Henry. And then later on, he became Abraham Washington's sidekick for his talk show segment. And he had that laugh that still haunts my dreams. 3 years ago this week, on October 8th, 2010, Paul Heyman had this to say in an interview with MMAWeekly.com about his potential involvement with TNA Wrestling. He said, "It came real close. I had a 5-year plan. I was going to spend 18 months building the roster, the next 18 months exploiting that roster. That's 3 years in. Go public in 3, stay for 2 more, running the thing, and then get out when I turn 50. I had an exit plan. I had a 5-year plan, and I clued everybody into it. I told TNA what my plan was. I told Spike TV what my plan was and how we could capitalize on it. and I acknowledge that wrestling is a diminishing market, and it's not perceived as cool, and here's what you do, if not to change the course, at least to present it differently, so that at least you have a chance in today's marketplace to compete. When that did not happen, that was it. I didn't have any other interest in doing it. It was real close. I would have done it for those particular terms, but that's it. That time has passed. So that was from Paul Heyman, and you know, it just makes you wonder what might have been. Heyman was never known for his great business acumen or anything like that. He was known for being a very creative guy, his ability to turn, you know, chicken shit into chicken salad. I've heard people use that expression before when it came to certain talents, you know, exploit their strengths and hide their weaknesses. There were a lot of guys on the ECW roster who couldn't wrestle, they couldn't do shit. But they were big time over with that crowd. Like a guy like 911, all he would have to do is chokeslam somebody and people would go crazy. You think 911 was some big talented guy? No. But Paul Heyman knew how to book somebody like that. So that's really what he was known for. And you know, TNA may still have had many of the same money problems they're having right now had Heyman come aboard. But I wonder, you know, creatively, how different things would look had Paul Heyman come to TNA. And if it would have made a big enough difference to really move numbers and expand their audience. If Heyman comes in and his plan works and there's some signs of life with the product, who knows? Maybe Dixie's parents are willing to spend a little more money than they are right now. And now they tighten the purse strings so much that they have to lay guys off and they're cutting back on their expenses. So who knows if that might be different today. I always figured if Heyman went to TNA, Brock Lesnar would have ended up back there instead of in WWE. But I don't know that he would have been willing to take less money over working for Vince McMahon just out of loyalty to Paul Heyman. I just felt if Heyman went over, they would have had a shot at somebody like Brock. Brock was a big enough name back then. You know, let's say he retires like he does, right, from MMA. He pops up on TNA television instead, and Paul Heyman builds around him and builds around guys like Samoa Joe and AJ Styles and Aries and guys like that. Then who knows? You know, it's fun to think about. Hogan and Bischoff wouldn't be there, that's for sure. 3 years ago this week, 10-10-10, TNA held its Bound for Glory pay-per-view. Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, and Mr. Anderson headline for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. Eric Bischoff comes down to the ring with a chair to interfere. Hulk Hogan's music hits. Bischoff pretends to be scared. Hogan was on crutches. He had just had knee surgery. So he ends up giving a crutch to Jeff Hardy, who steps in between him and Bischoff, and all of a sudden, Jeff Hardy shocks the world by clobbering Kurt Angle with a crutch, and I do mean clobbering him. He smashed him with that crutch right across the back of his neck, and then he hits Anderson with the other crutch. He gives him a twist of fate, gets the pin, and becomes the new heel heavyweight champion, the first time Jeff Hardy was a heel. A bunch of guys make their way down to the ring afterwards. Abyss, Jeff Jarrett, they all embrace Hogan and Hardy. It's just one big celebration. Rob Van Dam comes out. He's stunned. Can't believe what he just saw. He's asking Jeff Hardy what the hell he's doing. All of a sudden, Hardy nails Van Dam with the title belt. And they go off the air with the mother of all swerves. I'm sure Bischoff and them were so happy when that whole thing was over. Of course, they ended up swerving themselves right out of whatever business Jeff Hardy was doing for them at the time at house shows and in merchandise sales. He was the only guy really moving numbers for them at the time, so naturally they turned him heel. A few months later came that debacle at Victory Road, the 92nd match with Sting, where Hardy was in no condition to perform, yet they allowed him to go out there anyway. I talked a lot about that shitty finish in the main event at Battleground last weekend, but that was nothing compared to the main event that TNA gave its paying fans on that show. 1 year ago this week, on October 8th, 2012, on Monday Night Raw, CM Punk wrestled Vince McMahon in the main event. They had a brief but quite epic kendo stick battle during the match where both guys just whipped the hell out of each other with sticks. It was an awesome visual. Ryback came out to save Vince McMahon later on. Punk retreated into the crowd. This was the show where CM Punk punched a fan in the stands, and it made headlines all over the place on TMZ and everywhere else. Some dude was being a dick and slapping Punk from behind, so he finally snapped. And he turned around, and he just cracked the guy right in the face as he was putting on his glasses. The only problem is, he hit the wrong fan. So that sucked. So yeah, that was a year ago this week. And that's This Week in Wrestling History. If you have questions for the mailbag, please email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I also want to give some praise here. I mentioned him a little bit earlier on, very briefly, but I want to give praise to TV Tracks on YouTube, which is a popular channel on YouTube. They have a ton of subscribers over there. He has been maybe the biggest supporter of this show for a number of years now, and just in terms of helping spread awareness about it, posting clips of the show on his channel to get people interested in listening to full episodes and become... I mean, I've picked up a lot of fans. I have a lot of people who email me and send me messages saying, hey, you know, I first discovered your show on YouTube on the TV Tracks channel, and now I'm a big listener. I'm a big fan. I've gone back in the archives. I've listened to full shows. And it really is a cool thing. You know, it means a lot to me when I hear stuff like that. We picked up a ton of people who might not have otherwise known about the Sound Off, thanks to the TV Tracks channel. So I just want to give him a quick plug here. You can check him out. There's a ton of content, not just from the Sound Off, but from some other shows as well. You know, Don Tony and Kevin Castle and all this stuff. And there's comments in some of those videos on there, by the way, where it's like comparing my show to theirs. You know, Solid Monster, you suck, they rule, or your show rules, they suck, and all this stuff. Just, we don't need the fighting. Come on. Stop the fighting. Variety is good. Otherwise, you end up with an army of drones, kind of like we had in WWE years ago. Remember where everybody had to sound the same and look the same? Had Dolph Ziggler change his hair color one time. He was a dead ringer for Ted DiBiase. It was a dark period in wrestling where everybody looked and sounded the same. At least now, especially if you watch NXT, you see a lot of different characters. They look different and they sound different. It's not as bad as it used to be. My point is, I was trying to use a wrestling analogy here. My point is, variety is good. There's no need to fight. There's a lot of good content on there, so definitely check him out and let him know that you appreciate it. You appreciate him supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle, and we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. We're all over Facebook, by the way. That's the official profile page where we just hit 2,000 friends, so thank you for that. But we also have a fan page on there that I try to keep updated, and if you haven't liked that page yet, please give us a like. And we also have a closed discussion group on Facebook as well, so type in the full name of the show. You have to apply for membership, and I will approve you as we approach 600 members. We're going to hit 600 pretty soon. Hopefully you are one of them. You can also listen to this show each and every week on Stitcher Radio for free on your desktop, on your mobile device. If you listen to us in Stitcher, you're really contributing. You're helping the show out a lot. You can put us in your playlist on there. So download the free Stitcher app and listen to us on there. If you have an Android device, we have a free app in the Google Play Store. We're all over the place. So if you ever have problems downloading the show in iTunes, or you try Podbean and the link is down, and by the way, when that happens, it's usually brief. So my advice to you there is just keep trying. But you never have an excuse not to listen to the Sound Off. If one method doesn't work for you, there's three or four other ones that will. You're always plugged in when it comes to the Sound Off. So check us out all those different ways. We're on YouTube again. I'm publishing fresh content exclusive to YouTube. My username on there is TheSolomonster, all one word. Check out my Battleground review. Check out the Triple H DVD review, which will be going up later today. You can make a PayPal donation to the show on TheSolomonster.com. A lot of you guys have. You can do that. You can buy a shirt or an iPhone case from the Sound Off Superstore, SolomonsterSpreadshirt.com. There's a ton of different ways that you can support this show. The best way, though, is to keep listening and to just spread the word to friends and family about us, and I very much appreciate that. So, until 297 next weekend, we're getting ever so close to episode 300. I can't really say I have anything special planned at this point. I guess that could change, and I'm certainly open to suggestions, but I think people love the show as is. I don't have any real desire to deviate from that format or do an interview or anything like that. But yeah, we're on course. If we don't miss any shows between now and then, to hit episode 300 right on the show's six-year anniversary next month. And that's pretty cool stuff. So until next time, be well, stay safe, thank you again, and we'll see you right back here next weekend for 297.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solid Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesolidmonster.com. iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. The Solomonster Sounds Off.